This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehigis Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
And so we're now pleading to the donors that please, we cannot turn our back on the innocent families and children out there.
That's World Food Program Executive Director David Beasley, who calls the food security situation in South Sudan a crisis that requires urgent intervention. Details coming up. Also, Sudan marks the one-year anniversary of the protest that led to a new government. And opposition parties in Rwanda are condemning the demolition of homes by the government. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, a year ago today, thousands of people around Sudan began mass demonstrations against former President Omar al-Bashir's government over shortages of bread and fuel and skyrocketing prices. A few months later, riots swept across the country, leading military commanders to oust Bashir on April 11th. Many Sudanese say although there have been improvements made since that day, certain freedoms are still not being observed by the transitional government. Bashir was convicted last weekend in Khartoum for corruption, but many Sudanese say he must still face the more serious charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity leveled against him in The Hague. A transitional government with both civilian members and military leaders now is in charge. There are plans for an election to install a fully civilian government within 3 years. The UN World Food Programme, WFP, executive director warned today more than 4 million South Sudanese may slide into famine in the next 6 months if funding gaps are not urgently met to enable WFP to pre-position food aid on time. David Beasley says the food insecurity situation was worsened by the recent floods which affected nearly 1 million South Sudanese. Waki Simon Wudu has more from the capital Juba.
WFP Executive Director David Beasley, who is visiting South Sudan in the wake of floods that have destroyed the crops, livestock and livelihoods of hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese, calls the food security situation in the country a crisis that requires urgent intervention.
And so we're now pleading to the donors that please, we cannot turn our back on the innocent families and children out there. Failure to raise the money we need during this crisis period very well could mean the loss of lives. It could mean famine conditions.
Aid agencies say nearly 1 million people need assistance after their animals, produce and other resources were destroyed by the floodwaters. Beasley warns if the crisis is not addressed quickly, it could be a source of conflict within South Sudanese communities and cause a wave of immigration to other countries. Matthew Hollingworth, the WFP country director in South Sudan, says 4.5 million affected people now face acute and emergency levels of food insecurity. Hollingworth says when people face acute or emergency levels of food insecurity, they may slide into catastrophic food insecurity, which means a state of famine, and that can lead to many deaths if not addressed quickly. He says South Sudan is already at the worst level of malnutrition.
We are already, from a nutrition perspective, above the emergency threshold for malnutrition in the world today, with 16% malnutrition in young children, and 15% is the global emergency threshold. When you're above that, you've already crossed a red line. This country has already crossed that line.
Hollingworth says WFP may be forced to scale down its operations if the aid agency does not secure the required funding in the expected time. He says while the year-long cessation of hostilities by the parties to the conflict has improved farmers' agricultural activities and food production output, other drivers, including the recent flooding, have remained troubling factors.
The situation that people have felt because of past historic fighting in their areas, the situation because of droughts in the previous years, the situation because of the economy, and the very fragile economy across the country, inflation that again has accumulated over the past years. And then with all of that, to then be hit by the floods that have had a devastating effect.
Basil says it is time the parties to South Sudan's peace deal recognize that food insecurity is a threat to national security.
We need this conflict to end so that people can go on with their lives. This nation can be the beacon of hope that so many believe in, because people are good people, and the people, I think, can achieve great things. They just need to be given that opportunity. And right now, nothing but war and conflict in the way.
WFP officials say Maban and parts of Jonglei State are expected to be the hardest hit areas by the famine conditions. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
There are an estimated 100,000 Malawian migrant workers in South Africa, driven there by low incomes at home and the prospect of better jobs. A European Union-sponsored project is trying to reduce the number of Malawians leaving the country and encourage migrants to return by offering job training for self-employment. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
After years of struggling to feed his family, tailor Jeffrey Panga went to South Africa in 2012 in search of better paid work. But like many Malawian migrant workers, his five-year stay in Johannesburg did not go as well as he had hoped. He says for the first 3 years, my working pattern was on and off. I couldn't find a proper job. Things did not work as expected. In 2016, Panga's employers at a state high school found out he was undocumented and fired him, along with six other illegal Malawians working as cleaners. Instead of struggling for work in South Africa, he returned home and started his own business, thanks to a project run by the International Organization for Migration. Nana Amaja Poma Opon is projects officer for IOM.
The target is for 500 Malawi nationals to be received back home. At the moment, we've received 426, and we've been able to assist 241 with their livelihood projects.
The European Union-funded project helps migrant workers stranded in South Africa return home and get job training in poultry farming and other trades. The project helped Panga open a tailoring shop in Blanta, where he also trains others like him. He says, I don't have plans to migrate. That's why I am making sure to find a means to earn a living. This is because the owner of the place has been there. So he tells us about how good and bad of going abroad. Xenophobic attacks this year in South Africa spurred some Malawians to return home, but an estimated 100,000 or more are still working in the country. Despite steady economic growth, Malawi remains one of the world's poorest countries, with about 80% of people limited to working on farms. Hudson Mankwala is the chief director in the Malawi Ministry of Homeland Security.
You know, there is a problem of unemployment. It's everywhere, but back in Malawi, we still have a lot of youth, even graduates from colleges, they can't get jobs.
While the IOM project is helping to expand the range of jobs Malawi officials say they are also founding community, technical and training colleges. Their success will be measured by the number of Malawians who stay in the country or return home to make a living. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
A commission of inquiry into the sale of state land in and around urban areas has unearthed corruption costing Zimbabwe's government billions of dollars. Adi Gondo has more.
The Commission of Inquiry released its report last week, nearly 2 years after its appointment. It says that since 2005, urban planning and development took place on 170 farms, mostly without valuation. The state suffered prejudice through either undervaluation of urban state land or complete failure to value it. The report unearthed poor record keeping, poor financial management, and failure to invoice developers and beneficiaries. The total value of the farms was put at more than US$3 billion, with the government recovering less than 10% of the intrinsic value. The commission named top ruling party officials who exerted undue influence on government institutions and processes. Observers say the culture is pervasive. Political analyst Thomas Stolle weighs in on the matter.
What struck me from the commission findings is the manner in which urban land was acquired and parceled out, leading to the state being prejudiced to the tune of close to $3 billion. Especially looking at how aspiring or sitting politicians were given leverage to acquire and parcel out state land to their supporters. It talks to the culture of massive corruption, the culture of impunity that is prevalent in our state. These are economic crimes that have impoverished the citizenry of Zimbabwe. The state looked the other way.
Roderick Fayayo, another political analyst, says political cabals are reigning supreme in shady deals in the country.
The report is clear that few individuals in positions of authority are abusing their positions at the expense of the nation. Unfortunately, I think it clearly speaks to misgovernance. You go to all the local authorities, the backlog for people on the waiting list is just too big. And then you wonder, why is it that now we have got land barons? What are the local authorities administering? What is the Minister of Lands and the Minister of Local Government in conjunction doing? Because if they were hands-on, all the state land was not going to be taken by individuals. Because
the commission recommends that investigations, including lifestyle audits of all officers past and present, involved or connected with management of urban state land since 2005 on allegations of abuse of office, receiving bribes, and general corrupt conduct. It also calls for enforced payment of intrinsic value by all allocatees of urban state land based on updated valuations. President Emmerson Mnangagwa said he would act against the land barons after the report revealed glaring excesses and acts of corruption by land barons and their supporters. Stolle believes the big fish will escape without real punishment.
Those who are politically correct or who belong to a faction that is currently in charge of the state affairs can commit whatever crime can be involved in high-profile corruption cases and get away with murder. Well, this report, just like others that have been done before it, will gather dust. It's a brilliant report. If you go through it, it details how land has been parceled out illegally and in a criminal way by land barons, by politicians who wield power and influence. And we are yet really to see real action. My prediction and my reading of report and commission finding is that just like other findings or commission reports that were issued before, it will gather dust. It will only be used when it is politically expedient to do so.
Observers note that the Commission of Inquiry was appointed in the euphoric days after President Robert Mugabe was ousted, but reformist ideals have since faded with the revival of the old harsh reality. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo.
You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Opposition parties in Rwanda are condemning the government's demolition of homes, it says, were built on hazardous wetlands. Eugene Uwimana has more from Kigali.
More than 2,000 Kigali residents have become homeless since Kigali city officials began demolishing the homes this week. Some are living on the streets, others have temporary lodging in schools or with relatives. Frank Habineza, president of the Democratic Green Party of Rwanda, says the demolition has been done abruptly.
They are causing people to become refugees in their own country. They are low-income earners in this country, and they are many. And now if you just throw them out, where do you expect them to go?
For us, as the Democratic Green Party of Rwanda, we are not happy with that. We think that the city authorities should have a better way of planning things instead of doing things abruptly and causing people to hate the authorities, the government.
Rwandan dissident Victoire Ingabire, with the unregistered party DALIFA, or Development and Liberty for All, also has condemned the move. The government began forcing out hundreds of families several days ago in what it says is an effort to clear wetlands that are prone to flooding and landslides. It says it gave plenty of notice for residents of the areas to move on their own, but it was forced to remove those who remained. Pidansi Rubingisa is the mayor of Kigali City. He told VOA the city did plan for the demolitions and even delayed them to allow people to move.
It's not a poor planning to relocate people, only that we expected them to relocate from themselves, and they didn't do that. As I said, only 2% decided to relocate, and then we had to come in and try to relocate them.
Habineza says his Democratic Green Party of Rwanda doesn't want people to live in high-risk zones, but he says there should have been a plan of expropriation and relocation.
So if you want to these people to move away from their homesteads, then plan for them, make them an exit plan, build for them where they should go, and pay them, do a proper expropriation. We have an expropriation law. There is a way things should be handled, but you don't just come and you just start destroying someone's house. When even the persons are inside the house, or even their properties, you've seen a lot of women are crying and children, and so it's not so good. It's not good at all.
Habineza, who is a member of parliament, has written to the speaker to ask that the issue be first on today's parliamentary session agenda. The speaker rejected the request.
But it was not possible at the last minute because I was informed that I needed to have citizens' signatures. The citizens should have signed on the petition, so that's why I was not able to table the motion today.
The Rwandan government says that in total, 7,222 houses and other buildings, such as garages and factories, need to be demolished immediately to save lives during this rainy season. Critics say, given the attention the matter has drawn, they hope that it will now be handled with more caution. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
This week, the UNHCR held a global refugee forum in Geneva. Delegates from government ministries, humanitarian groups, and refugees came to pledge support for the estimated 70 million people who've been forced from their homes by conflict, poverty, and disaster. Nearly half of those refugees are children whose specific needs often get lost in the mix. To help child refugees in Ethiopia and Uganda, the LEGO Foundation pledged $100 million for its Play Matters initiative. The program promotes play as a key way to help kids learn while helping them cope with the many difficulties they face. To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Sarah Bouchie, head of global programs for the LEGO Foundation based in Denmark. He said that LEGO's goals run deeper than selling the toy building bricks it is most famous for.
At the LEGO Foundation, we've done a lot of research over the last about decade and a half to try to learn about how children learn best. And what the evidence seems to show us is that play encourages brain development. When kids are really engaged in a process, they are able to retain information better. And when we bring play into that equation, they have interdisciplinary learning, and we know that that's really great for developing the kinds of skills that children need to survive in school and really thrive as they become adults.
Will you be sending tons of Lego bricks for kids to be playing with?
Lego bricks could be a part of the project if our partners feel like it's appropriate on the ground. And we know that it's not practical for every child to get a Lego brick. It's really more about changing attitudes and behavior and finding ways to play every day and every moment.
Give me a thumbnail sense of how educators can use play in their classrooms.
It's really simple. It's following the lead of children and doing it in ways that are joyful and meaningful so kids can try things and fail them and try and fail. And in that process, they learn what works in a way that engages them. Also, we know that being socially interactive, so the more that children do it with other children, they have to negotiate things like communication skills. That's important.
I know play can be especially important for kids in traumatic or difficult situations.
Yes, play provides comfort. It helps children to overcome traumatic experiences. It builds resilience, and especially when it's combined with education, it helps children to return to routine and normalcy of being a child. And those are really important when you have faced adversity or when you have a lot of stress in your life.
What's an example of a resource you'll be offering these educators?
One of the things that they are going to work on is a digital library that can be deployed for teachers to understand better what does a different kind of classroom look like. So it might be that teachers get a training about what learning through play looks like. So how do you run a lesson differently to make it more interdisciplinary and more provoking children's ideas? And then we'll see which of those messages and videos really resonate with teachers. When do they need support? Is it during the classroom time? Is it on a regular training basis? Do they need to have learning circles that go along with these videos? Do they need in-depth training? Do they need mentorship for a period of time?
Of course, schooling for refugee children can be very informal when they have access to it at all. Are you going to be building schools, per se?
We anticipate that we'll be working in existing schools that are already serving refugees, and we know that those classrooms are already overcrowded. So what can we do to make sure that the learning environments are really most productive for children? And as part of the project, we're also trying to train about 170,000 primary caregivers, so families too, so that they can know how do they support learning at home. That might be through games, that might be through songs, that might be, for example, a game with counting stones that might be already going on in the home. How can you use that counting to help really children reinforce ideas about numbers or early numeracy?
You sound very excited and hopeful.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are two things that are really great for the Lego Foundation. First of all, we are new in the humanitarian space, so trying to reach the children who most need it is a wonderful thing to be a part of. And then second, the scale that we're trying to reach is ambitious, but it's time to be really serious about how refugee children and the host communities that they live within are being supported in a really difficult time.
That was Sarah Bushi, head of global operations for the Lego Foundation. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York in connection with the Global Refugee Forum, which was held this week in Geneva, Switzerland. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nashwan Kali, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
voaafrica.com.
On voaafrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
voaafrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.